Hello, and welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharakana. We invite you to join us on Thursdays at 8 p.m. for an engaging exchange with us and our special guest as we cover various topics regarding history, genealogy, and your personal family history stories. Hello, I'm Janice Gilliard.
And I'm Sharakana Feliciano. Welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharakana. Thank you for joining us, and be sure to check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Today, we're joined by our guest, Ms. Denise Griggs. Denise Griggs is an author of books for children and young adults about genealogy, diversity, and theology. She's the owner-publisher of Blue Eclipse Publishing for young adults and owner-publisher of Glass Tree Books for children. She earned her BA and MA degrees from a Christian university and has worked in both education and ministry. Ms. Griggs volunteered for over 30 years in children's ministry, family genealogy research, and teaching African-American genealogy. She has researched the Griggs and Hunt families for over 40 years and for the Hunt family back to 8th century England and Ireland. She's connected with DNA cousins in Ireland, Canada, England, MS, and across the United States.
Denise is a 2021 Phyllis Wheatley Award recipient from the Sons and Daughters of the United States Middle Passage, a 2022 Finalist Award recipient from the Next Generation Indie Book Award in the category of History and Culture. She is the exhibit chair of the Greater Sacramento Genealogy Society and a prospective member of the Daughters of the American Revolution. She also volunteers for the subcommittees of history and research, part of the PR marketing team for the Natchez U.S. Colored Troops UST Monument Committee, Natchez, Mississippi, a volunteer for the National Park Service, and she has an ancestor who was a homesteader listed on their Black Homesteader webpage. Welcome to Speak On It, Denise.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for inviting me, and I'm just absolutely honored to be here and to share with you my family's history.
Thank you. So Denise, in your book, A Mulatto Slave, The Events in the Life of Peter Hunt from 1844 to 1915, it's noted that the story is an introduction to young teens about families during slavery in America, and it's written in the style of the Writers Federal Project, WPA, of the 1930s, when African-American former slaves were interviewed. Please share why you decided to use this format or style for your book.
Well, the reason I wrote it for young adults is that, you know, life is not always what it said or appears to be. And so on the book cover, on the front, I have words that are in shades of gray. But then on the back, they're in red and black. So it's kind of tying in, you know, that there's always something between the lines. I also wrote a poem that expressed the same thing that's in the book. And it says, between the sheets of black and white, gray and blue divide, ever spilt the red life force, the truth, a shared bloodline. Mm-hmm. So it's telling us by the cover as well as by the poem that life isn't what it's said to be. Otherwise, my complexion. You know, if we were so awful, why did you keep right. going back to the well, so to speak?
Right.
So that's really the point for the young adults. But you know, after reading the WPA narratives, I kind of began to see a pattern of how a lot of them were saying, "Oh yeah, slavery was good." And master was good. And I wish those days were back there. And I begin to think, you know, my dad always, when he told us our bedtime stories, he'd say, okay, now what's the moral of the story? Mm-hmm. Or what's your opinion about the story? You know, and he'd let us express it. And so I began to say, well, something's going on here. And no matter that they were free, they wouldn't dare to say anything that would jeopardize their freedom. They didn't know if it was going to be permanent, and you wouldn't dare say nothing uppity, you know, about a white person in the past or the present. So that's what I began to see. And also when the one woman said, this black man was very articulate and he spoke very well because he worked in the house, but she insisted he talk in slave speak. And so he went right into, yes, ma'am, massa, you know, just really slurring his words and sounding like he didn't have a lick of education. And I thought, you know, this is an old cat and mouse game, the deceiver playing the deceived, no matter which side it was on. And the transcriber, they could change that story any way they wanted to.
Right.
Yeah.
I like that's, how you... You yes. mentioned that because in the intro in the of the book, you kind of expounded further on that and how that relates to African American folklore with Br'er Rabbit and Br'er Bear. Can you kind of explain, you know, for our listeners, how that, you know, played into the ways in which sometimes the enslaved and the formerly enslaved would share their stories?
Right. Well, those stories, Uncle Remus Tales, that's what it's called. And it was a white person who made the money off telling the stories.
Right.
But even with our dad, he told us those bedtime stories. And when he didn't have the book, he'd draw it out. Br'er Bar, Br'er Rabbit, you know, we were all laughing and whatever. And but the whole thing of the story was, especially Br'er Rabbit, that he was thrown into the briar patch and he was just screaming and hollering to Br'er Fox and Br'er Bar, please don't throw me in the briar patch. Cook me, boil me, eat me, anything. Just don't throw me in the briar patch. And when they did, they thought, oh, this is how we'll forever get rid of him. When they threw him in the briar patch, he jumped up and said, I was born and bred in the briar patch and that's where I always want to be. And so my dad was letting us know, you know, how to decide about a situation. How can you look at that situation and decide how to get out of it without getting killed, you know, or getting home on time so you wouldn't be caught in that situation. So slaves, they would teach this to their children since they brought them over from Africa on how to outthink, how to use your wits to get yourself out of situations or keep yourself from getting into situations where you could be captured, like in Africa or here in the States as slaves. So those were like, you know, sort of like the quilt, how to get over here, how to get there, how to get home. The North Star, the sisters, the three sisters or something like that. My grandparents taught us that, how to find out how to get home. So if you couldn't read, like so many of them couldn't, you needed those stories to help your children. And unfortunately, we've kind of lost that.
I think the slave narratives are important. And I think that, you know, I know for me, I discovered one for an ancestor. And pretty much what was in that one was true. My grandmother had told me so many different things. So I think if you have one for an ancestor, it's important if you have some type of your historical record or oral history that you see it lines up, and then you have to read them with an open mind. So this is the first time I'm hearing, you know, a take on it the way you presented it. That's very interesting.
So your book is entitled A Mulatto Slave, The Events in the Life of Peter Hunt, 1844 to 1915. Can you share with our listeners when you discovered Peter Hunt and what are some of the noteworthy events in his life that you would like to share?
Well, I was in my 20s and that was a long time ago. I asked my great aunt when we went to Mississippi and she was my grandfather's sister. And I was like, Aunt Julie, I said, who's the picture on the wall? And then she said, oh, that's Peter Hunt. So at that time, I was young enough that I wasn't supposed to ask questions, you know, of the older folks. So after I got married and finally came back there a couple of years later, I kept looking at the picture. It was almost as if the picture was looking at me, but I kept looking in the other room. And finally, my auntie said, she said, baby, why do you keep looking in my parlor? What's going on? And I said, I really need to know. I said, Aunt Julie, I'm only going to ask you once, like I had asked my grandpa. And I said, you only have to tell me the answer once and I'll never ask you again. She said, okay. I said, why do you have a picture of that white man on your wall in your parlor? I said, I don't get it. Who's the white guy? And she looked at me and she kind of laughed. She says, that's no white man. I said, well, I'm looking at him. She says, that's great Uncle Peter. And I'm like, okay. She said, he was the son of the slave owner. And I'm like, what? And I said, well, what else do you know? She says, well, I know he was a tanner, and his sister, which was my great-great-grandmother, and I finally found out her name then. She said she was a weaver, and they didn't work in the fields like the rest of them. And I'm like, really? And the mother was the cook, but Aunt Julie didn't know her name. And so anyway, she was telling me, she said, and his people came from across the sea. And I'm like, from where? She goes, I don't know, baby. They didn't tell me that. I said, well, is there anything else I should know? She said, well, he fought in a great war. And wow. He raised my mama. And I was like, why? Why did Grandma Eula have to be raised by him? So she told me, well, the mother died and he raised her. And I'm like, oh, and her other two kids. So she said, and I said, well, how is it he's a slave? Mm-hmm. And that he fought in this great war. And I'm like, what war? And she goes, I don't know, baby. They didn't tell me that. So I had enough clues to just take off.
Wow.
So that's how I found out about Peter Hunt. But I did find out the Civil War was called the Great War.
Wow. Isn't it amazing how conversations can start over pictures?
Just a picture.
Many of our guests have said that, you know, that there was this picture on the wall, and what's the story behind it, you know?
Yeah, one question, that's it.
Mm-hmm. So have you connected with other descendants of Peter?
Yes. Hunt?
And if so, how did you make the connections?
Well, all the connections have been over the internet. I've talked to a couple of them, but I've met both black and white. I have cousins in Ireland. One cousin in Ireland, you know, over the internet, at first I'd wait about till about the third email and I'd say, oh, by the way, I would say I'm African-American, also Native American. And then I'd say white because of the connection between the two of us. I'd say, well, okay, your great-great-great-grandfather is also my great-great-great-grandfather. And so I have cousins, like I said, in Ireland, England, Canada, and Australia. And the person in Australia, he wrote a book. I'll put it up here. It's thick.
Wow.
And it's about the Hunt family. But he took my book and put it in his book because now his is just strictly genealogy, rarely any stories, but he has it in there. But they have it in also another Burke's Landed Gentry. They know that this particular Hunt family came to the Americas, they landed in Georgia, but no one knew what happened to them. Well, 300 of them went back to Ireland, but these particular individuals, they didn't know what happened to them. So I told him, I said, well, I can tell you what happened to them after they got here. And he said, well, I can take you back to the 8th century. And so we started sharing information. I don't fight with people over the internet. And I tell every African-American, do not pick a fight. Uh-huh. Do not get the information and then curse them out. I've known of people who've done that, but you can't do it. So with all my relatives, we're all descended, actually from Fitzmaurice Hunt from Ireland, County Tipperary, but we're all descended. So we're all trying to feel one another out, trying to make sure we're not going to fight. And we've had relationships for 10 years. And through this book, I also found out Peter's second and third great grandchildren. They had no clue. They knew nothing about him, didn't even know he existed. And one of his third great grandson was the mayor of the city, just about where Peter worked and was raised. He had no idea. And that the great-great-grandfather, this third great-grandfather who was a slave owner, he was also a sheriff. So, Wow. Yeah. So you find out all this information by sharing.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's a great point that you raised too about, you know, exchanging just kind of the steps, I suppose, and the strategies of sometimes the interracial connections that we have to make and the ways that we try to navigate it because we're not sure how the conversation could go. Right. And, you know, sometimes you might receive information that's a little upsetting. And it's not that you don't have a right to be upset, right? But right. You know, in this stage where we're trying to gather information, you know, doing things to increase our chances of success.
Right.
What's interesting too, you noted the 300 or so that had gone back to Ireland. Do you know why so many went back?
Yes, they came over. He was like the patriarch of the family, and he brought all these other families over from Ireland. They all left County Tipperary and they came over to the United States and they purchased land. They were going to all settle down here, but the American Revolution, with them having English ancestry and British, they didn't want to get caught up because years prior, the Hunt family was banned to Ireland for consorting or whatever with a king who eventually lost. So when the American Revolution was about to start, they decided to go back. But however, three of the sons stayed. They were like, they knew if they went back to Ireland, they were not going to inherit because this man had 20 kids. So there were several brothers over them and they decided to stay here and try their hand. And they joined, well, I know Fitz Morris, he joined Chandler's army in Georgia to fight. He's registered to fight during the American Revolution.
Wow. So,
and then they received land from the government for signing up. So he stayed here and married and raised a family in Georgia prior to moving to Mississippi. After his wife died, he just went to Mississippi because it was just opening up.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Thank you for sharing that.
Uh-huh.
So you just received the 2022 Next Generation Indie Book Award in the category of African American History and Culture. What impact did receiving this award have on you? And what do you think your ancestors would think?
Oh, don't make me cry. Well, if it wasn't for Bernice Bennett, who told me about it, I probably wouldn't have tried to get into the category, into the contest in the first place. But needless to say, I'm just so pleased because it was my first try and Bernice told me about one man who's been trying to win for the last 5 years. So, but he hasn't. And I just was floored. I was just so floored that I won that particular, well, I was a finalist in that particular category. And my ancestors, I think the one who would be the most impacted would be Peter and his mother. I mean, Peter, he was totally forgotten. My mom didn't know anything about him. And his grandchildren didn't even know him, you know. And so I think he would be the most impacted. And then the generation above, his mother, you know, who was also a slave, and she had to do what she had to do. Her children were by the slave owner, you know, and she also had children by another man who was, quote unquote, her African husband. So she had to play a delicate balance because there are church records that says her husband, they didn't call him the husband. They just call him the slave of Henry Hunt. He was put out of the church for drinking, put out of the church for stealing, baptized in the church. They baptized their slaves, you know,
right.
And then worked them, however, but, you know. So he was reacting because Peter was born about that time. Margaret, his sister, was born about that time and even prior. So of course he would probably get drunk or steal or whatever.
Yeah.
Because to express his own anger, he couldn't go around killing people because they would have killed all of them.
Right.
So you begin to, like I said, see things, see a pattern, see the story, get a feeling for what's going on. And then I have enough information about that slave owner that this guy was a piece of work. He was a young, he was the youngest of a bunch of girls, and being the sheriff and knowing what everybody had in whatever county he was in. And one of his sons tried to kill him.
Wow.
And yeah, so the son hung himself. So there are documents out there. You listen to that oral history and you're able to go along and say, okay, who are these people? If you do find out the slave owner, we knew the slave owner's last name, but never the first name or anything more about him. So once I was able to make friends, like I said, even though the man said, I'll tell you their names, where they come from, but do not ever contact me again.
Wow.
I was like, thank you. I won't. Or give her a copy of that 1822 will so she'll stop bugging us. I looked at the email and said, oh, okay, fine. Wasn't no need for me to get angry. That was the information I need.
Exactly.
You know, one lady said, we couldn't possibly be related.
My husband, I think like, the award receiving award, does that make you feel like, you know, I don't want to use the word vindication, but like you're honoring them, that this is for you, for your ancestors.
Right. I really do. My grandmother lamented all the time, oh, I wish I knew my papa's people.
Aww.
So I found them, but she had already died, but at least I found them. So.
Right.
And at least they're, not at least, but they are acknowledged.
Right,
as well.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Peter fought in the Civil War. Have you visited the African American Civil War Museum in Washington, D.C.? And also, have you received or reviewed his pension records?
Yes, I have his full pension records. Thanks to Bernice Bennett. And I did visit the Civil War Museum, but I already had the information about where his number was on the wall, and I already had his regiment and everything. So when I did go there, I was in DC for something else, and I ran over there, my sister and I, and they happened to be having, I guess, the day where people tell about their families.
Right,
and so
right.
He told the person who was supposed to speak, he said, Dr. Smith said, you let her go up and speak today. So I told them about Peter Hunt. They bought several books from me. And then it was really emotional. Two reenactors, a washerwoman and a soldier, USCT soldier, escorted me over to the wall. And I failed to send you that picture, but you couldn't see. I was crying. The tears were just flowing.
Where's the bucket? I need a bucket, not tissue. I need a bucket.
But they walked me across the street, and I honestly felt like I was going to meet Peter Hunt. But that the quandary was that I also felt I was going to attend his funeral. Mm. So still get a little emotional. That was about 15 years ago, but still, it was just overwhelming. And so Dr. Smith said, oh my God, she's got everything where he is. Take her straight over there. We didn't have to look it up or anything. So it was truly emotional, and everybody should go see that. Knowing anything about your ancestor or who was in the Civil War, or even the fact that you benefited from it, you should see that, all those soldiers' names listed.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Can you share a little bit too about the process of the pension records and retrieving the pension records?
Well, you have to go on, I usually use Ancestry. You have to get the little card, and it tells when they filed, the certificate number. And so when you go to NARA, you have to put that in and request that record. You're not going to get it for at least an hour, maybe if you put it in the morning, you might get it, you know, by 12 at least. And that's when you go in, you can't take pencils or pens, or you can't take pens for sure. and just a notepad. And so, and they'll make a copy of the entire file for you. I understand it's a little different now. You can go in and copy the records yourself.
Okay.
For them. But now you have to make an appointment to go. And if they have appointments for the time you want to go, you have to ask at least a month ahead of time.
This actually pretty booked out too, way ahead. I think the last time I checked, they were booked up until like August.
Yeah.
Well, I have Tony Carrier, actually. This was through the museum that they're building in Charleston. A couple of years ago, in conjunction with that, one of the things that they offered was if you had the pension card and you submitted that, they would pull the file for you.
Right.
So I submitted it. Unfortunately, I made it in before they cut everything, before they shut it down, I guess, or had to, you know, stop doing it. But I received the pension file for an ancestor and it was 150 pages.
Wow.
And it took me hours just to take my time and read through it. And it was very emotional because he had to fight so long just to get his pension. So going to that wall, you know, as you were describing that, and then the gentleman like saying, oh, take her over and you're being escorted. To me, I felt like that was meant to happen, that it's just a very spiritual moment and it was meant to happen.
Yes, yes.
For sure, for sure. So most of our listeners are dedicated researchers, and many of them are learning that they have ancestors that were Black homesteaders. Can you share a little bit about your ancestor who's listed on the National Park Service's website and a little bit about a project that you worked on?
Okay, Bernice Bennett again. My favorite person. She was telling me about homesteads because I wrote this book about 10 years ago. And I said that he purchased, and I was thinking, okay, I know some receive land maybe for fighting or that they receive money where they could buy the land. And Bernice had asked me, she said, did your ancestor buy that land or did he homestead it? And I was like, what's a homestead? You know, and I had the documents, but I didn't know, understand the act of May 1862. So she explained it to me and she said, didn't I send you that? You know, because I get her to go over to the archives and get things for me and get documents. And so we both looked and sure enough, it said the act of May 1862. So I ended up revising the book to clear that up. But I had also found Peter's descendants at the same time. I said, so let me go ahead and revise this, and a whole nother story just happened. It just kind of happened, you know, and which led me to something totally different, which I really won't go into it because I'm doing a documentary on it. But so many things had happened in that 10 years, I was able to revise it and straighten it out. But my Peter's mother, my third great grandmother, she too homesteaded, and she had 39 acres. And by the time she got the acres, and I saw it, by the time she got the actual homestead, she was 72 years old. Well, I almost fell out of my chair. I'm 72 years old. And I was like, such a connection, you know, and it just, like you said, such a spiritual connection. And then Peter, he homesteaded before she did, but it was right, she got hers right next to his. He had over 160 acres, right at 160 acres, because that's what you could homestead for. And then as I began to look at other people and look at the people on Peter's pension, as well as his homestead who vouched for him, they also had homesteads. So it was like a running thing in the family. Some still kept it. Peter's ancestors, they do have, still have the property. They're on the majority of the property. So the National Park Service decided that she would do a documentary on it. And she asked for different ones to send, to submit their video. So my twin sister and I, we did a video and we got selected. So it's also on that website and it's called Cultivating Connections. And we're sharing how we felt and that it was our third great grandmother. And she was born like 1820. Wow. So you're looking at the fact that, okay, there's something for 1820. Surely there must be county documents or some other document. That's a clue. Just that date is a clue. Who, how did he acquire her? Oh, and there's another thing I really want to talk about is that 1825 document, the slave mortgage.
Yes.
Henry Hunt had to, the slave owner had to list them by name, their age, and who he purchased them from, where he got them, whether it's his father's estate who died in 1822, another clue, or anything. All these names, you could backtrack them. And my grandfather always said that Hunt wasn't the real name for his side of the Hunts, but it was like two slaves, Marion and Hunt, and Hunt, you know. So he said the name was Smart. And that was that. I'll only ask you once. I'll never ask you again. I found it. I found the name Smart in that 1825 slave document. You know, wow. That was one of those fall out of your chair moments.
Right.
So everything is a clue.
Whatever you're looking for, it will come to you. Just don't stop looking.
Right.
And also, because we were treated as property, they documented everything. So you have to, if you're on Ancestry, look at those wills or go to the local courthouses. It's so important. That information is there. I find there's an estate inventory list of one of the enslavers for several of my ancestors, and they list their names and then they group them together. They have these little tick marks to the left where they're grouping them together and their value. So anytime someone says, oh, well, information doesn't exist, that is not true. It may be challenging, but you'll find it. Before we move on, I wanted to go back and the pension file for Peter Hunt. There was a note, it said disability from the measles.
Yes.
Contracted while he was in 6th Heavy Artillery during the Civil War.
Right.
Did he recover from that? Or
yes. Okay. There were thousands who died from the measles. That was such a deadly disease at the time. And a lot of the soldiers died from disease, not fighting or getting shot. And even in the colored troops. So Peter, he wasn't in there a month and he came down with the measles. I eventually met a woman whose ancestor, white ancestor, he was the chaplain for Peter's group. So while Peter was there in the hospital, he was in the hospital for a month, a solid month about the measles, and they thought for sure he was going to die. And I addressed that in the book, since Peter's doing the talking in the book. Well, anyway, I do address it and his mother coming and, you know, blah, 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 blah. But it ended up settling in his lungs and in his bowels. And that's where his disability came from eventually. So when he did file for the disability, it was about 1893, I believe. And he had problems. He had, sure, he could have passed for white and gone to another county and still had the problems or another state. But he stayed there and his brothers-in-law and other family members or people maybe he had to pay, they helped him on that farm. Some of them no doubt lived there too. So they even said how sick he would get in the wintertime when the cold set in, it would just wipe him out. And so that's how he ended up getting a disability. But one piece of paper in that pension file, I got his wife's name, his child's name, where they lived, who came to see him, all these others. So I have all these other names, clues, you know, where the gaps, the empty spaces, right, clues, right, because you want to fill those in. So, yeah, he did suffer terribly all through his life from the results of the measles.
When people do their research, when our listeners do their research, I just want to stress to them, if you see the word homestead, look it up, follow through on it. There's a story that I can't give all of the details now because something is being prepared for it. But there's a friend of mine who, she wrote like a little booklet and it was in there and I saw it and I called her and she was like, well, what's the big deal? I was like, really, you know, it's a big deal. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
And she's found some amazing, amazing information. But again, that's her story. I'm not going to go there with it. But I just wanted to stress to the listeners, if they see the word homestead, homestead.
Right. May 1862, because Lincoln approved it, and it wasn't to start until the January 1st, same day of emancipation. And in the homestead, they couldn't put down if you were black or white. Mm-hmm. Or if you could read or write. I mean, you know, there was just, you had to say, and you had to say what you did on the property. And my third great grandmother said she lived in a 16 by 16 home that she and her kids built for her. She had a bed, she had one table.
They detail everything.
Right. They had to detail everything to show how they improved it. And she had horses and the cows, and she had like 60 whatever barrels of corn, you know, things that she grew and what she did, as well as what Peter did. So I have about four on there now, but I've got six others to add, and wow, the other ones will be in the documentary. So it's fascinating when you find out and how proud they were. You know, it wasn't much, it really wasn't much even at that time, but it was theirs.
Right.
So well, my grandmother could come from slavery to emancipation, exactly, to owning land.
Right.
And men did vote. The black man did vote after 1867, and they registered to vote. They went to Congress. They went to, they were sheriffs, so many things. And in my history class, they told us we didn't do anything but chop cotton or got lynched or something. And I told him, I said, I don't believe you. And if you don't know what you're talking about, I don't need to listen to you. I said, because the only thing I do know is that another great-great-grandfather came out of slavery, owned cattle, owned a store, built a church. I said, so no, you can't tell me that. And a senator came to our high school and said, blacks didn't vote, and they didn't have much to do with politics. He knew just by asking me a question or two. I didn't know, and so he didn't tell us.
Right, but you know what? We have that responsibility coming along doing the research.
That's right.
To correct that historical narrative and to put it together and share it. I made a comment. I was in a meeting, and I said, you know, once hidden history is revealed, it should become a shared history.
Right, right.
It's so important. And back to the homesteaders, with my friend, when I explained to her the significance and how important it was, she was like, oh, well, I have a couple of those. And I was just like, what? So it turns out she has, I believe she has four or maybe up to five now of them, but she did not understand the importance of it. She was like, I just put it in there, and I'm like, wow. So
I didn't really know either till Bernice told me.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations on that find.
Thank you.
Big deal.
So, in closing, what are some parting words of inspiration or tips that you would like to share with our listeners?
One of the main things is whatever your oral history is, go by that, because what I tried to do was disprove it. That helped me to prove it or disprove it, because there was a story that just kind of didn't add up to me. And it wasn't the correct generation, it was the next generation. So always write your oral history down and pass it on. Also, I had a certified genealogist tell me, oh, oral history is bunk. You can't go by that. And, you know, I got offended. And that was the one time that I really blasted her. And I said, why are you going to tell me my grandparents lied to me? You know, people lie about a lot of things. We know that. But I had to stick to that and stick to my guns. And sure enough, that oral history will point you in the direction of that document. And I don't look for things pretty much in Mississippi. You have to know where you are. You may go there because your cousins live there, but you have to remember, they live there, you don't. So you don't go down there acting like you got to tell me this and you got to tell me that. But write it down. Also, start with yourself. Who are your parents? Whether you live with them or not, whether you have a relationship with them or not, write down your dad as much as you know across the top of a page. There are free ancestral charts online. Your mother, write down everything that you know, even the maiden names. But if you don't know the maiden names, don't worry. That's a clue. If you have all these empty spaces like I did at first, don't worry. That's just a clue to send you to where you need to find them. And somebody always knows your business, whether it's a neighbor or the government. Somebody knows and can tell you what
they need. That sounds like a book title. Somebody knew the business. Somebody knew their business.
I know. I need that on a shirt. Somebody knows.
I do that when I teach genealogy. I put that in there. Somebody always knows your business. So if it's your mom and daddy don't tell you, your auntie or your uncle will tell you. Yeah. I found more out from my aunties and uncles. look up old trails, the old Indian trails, even if it's the Pony Express. Find out what cities that it went to. Look up church records. In the book, I have church records. The earliest was 1818, because that's when Mississippi, right about that time, it became a state. Find out what Native Americans were there before your ancestors got there or before anybody got there. There's a chart that shows you where the Native Americans were living in the early 1700s, all the way through before they were some were forced out on the Trail of Tears. Not everybody left going to Oklahoma. Some stopped in Memphis, jumped ship, hit the hills because they were killing them on that transport with chicken pox, blankets, you know, filled with disease to get their money. Look at those wills and get your children to help. I was an administrator at a Christian school and we did genealogy one semester. And I tell you, those kids came up with some stories they had heard. But that particular pastor's father-in-law had died. And I told them, when you go to a funeral, have your family history so you can say this person was the son of, was the daughter of, was the grandchild. We do that in our family. Mm-hmm. At any funeral, now we get, well, usually it's me. I get up and say who was who was who until I get, and the last one I end it with is the African or the Indian. Mm-hmm. So remember to do that. But what the child did, I think he was in sixth or seventh grade, he told his mother, he said, Mama, you got to do this or I got to do this about grandpa. And so she said, what? Because she'd been helping him. He says, Sister Greg said, you got to get up there and say it. She got up there. And soon as you start the son of or the daughter of, everybody stops crying. And you could just see people reach for their purses and pull it out and they all start writing, you know, so do that. So your children will be proud of your ancestry instead of that your daddy wasn't nothing, your mama wasn't nothing, you ain't gonna be nothing, nobody would be nothing. You know how long we have heard that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also show your children. Blacks were elected to Congress. Blacks were, businessmen and women. It wasn't just Madam C.J. Walker. There were more. Or okay. Jack Johnson. There were more. If you can tie it into your family, fine. So that's what I would say. Everything is a clue. Whether it's a gap in your knowledge or something that you know, a date or time, it's a clue. You will find your family. And you'll enjoy it. Not everybody in your family want to hear it. Maybe at the family reunion. You know, and make sure when you have your family reunions, make sure you have a history table out there so people yes. can walk around and yes. see it and point to it. So anyway, that's all.
Thank you for that. Ms. Denise Briggs, thank you so much for joining us on Speak On It. You can visit Denise's website, blueeclipsepublishing.com and glasstreebooks.com, or you can check her out on Twitter. Twitter.com/DIGriggs. That's Griggs with two G's. Thank you for joining us. And we
thank you too.
Yeah, thank you. We look forward to sharing with you during our next segment of Speak On It.
Speak On It is a podcast and is immediately available to listen to at your leisure. Thank you.